Hello and welcome to this week's Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that tapes the top 10 and talks about it at school the next day. I'm Fraser McAlpine.
I'm Laura Snapes.
And well, first of all, Laura, where are you?
I am in the bedroom of an Airbnb in Los Angeles. So apologies for any diminished sound quality because I'm just doing it on my laptop this week. But I have seen more music this week than I think I've seen in the whole year so far. So it's pretty good. We'll get on to some of it later. How are you? Where are you?
I'm at home and you'll probably be able to hear my family going about their Easter business because we've had some issues with time differences and getting the recording bang on. So on this week's agenda, we're going to have a bit of a discussion about the global charts and the impact, not least of the Ed Sheeran album on the global charts, but how they're stacking up. We've had a couple of emails in from listeners. And the big news of the week, obviously, the world as we know it so far in Unbreak My Chart is over. The apocalypse is nigh and he is risen. And I think you'll know what we're talking about, but we'll get to it later. First of all, we've had an email. Laura, would you like me to read me the email?
Yes, this is from Thomas, who is in Australia, and he writes about their top 10, which at the time of his email was Ed Sheeran, Castle on the Hill at number 10, and number 9, Kygo and Selena Gomez, and number 8, Lord with Green Light, which is much higher than it is over here, and number 7, Bruno Mars, number 6, Kendrick Lamar with Humble, which is currently at number 31 in the UK, at number 5, Drake and Passion Fruit, number 4, Zedd featuring Alicia Cara, number 3, Chainsmokers and Coldplay, number 2, Galway Girl, number 1, Shape of You. Thomas says, I've been very much enjoying your podcast over the past few weeks. Thank you, Thomas. And it's got me to scrutinise the singles chart here in Australia for the first time in a while. The interesting, or perhaps not, thing is that, for the most part, the UK and Australian top tens are very much the same. There are, of course, a few differences. For instance, the dread duality hasn't had quite the same impact here. Sheeran only has a measly 3 songs in the top 10 this week and 8 in the top 50 overall, whereas Passion Fruit is at number 4 is Aubrey's only appearance before Fake Love at number 47. Plus, Lord's Greenlight is entering its 4th week in the top 10, and rightly so. But the higher end of the chart is mostly the same players as you've discussed on the podcast in the past 3 weeks, and there's no sign of any Australian acts until Call On Me by Starley at number 23, a song spending its 19th week on the table. Australian acts only make up 8% of the top 50 this week, which isn't an unusually low figure. With this in mind, do you think that the current chart model based heavily on streaming is a major contributing factor to an international top 10 congruence, or do you reckon the influence of UK and US pop juggernauts overseas would still be as pronounced if it were only sales being taken into account? Fraser, what do you think?
I think that it probably is more of a factor in areas where where the countries are all English speaking. So I think there is a widespread assumption that pop music is an English language art form, that in countries where the primary language is not English, that assumption is not, it's not prevalent. There's a lot to be said for English language pop, but it isn't the be all and end all. So I think it's interesting that there are so many local Australian artists that aren't appearing on their chart. And I think that possibly would make a difference if Australia was a country that had its own language that wasn't English.
Yeah, I think the only kind of grounds for geographic differentiation here is Lord being in the top, properly in the top 10, as she should be, with the amazing Green Light, I suppose, because she is, although obviously from New Zealand, a much more local artist to them than she is to us. But I think it's such a shame that song has not yet broken the UK top 10, but hopefully it's on its way, as we're going to get onto later.
Yeah. And we've had another email, so this should prove at least my theory to be partly correct. We've had an email from Brazil. This is from Anna, and she says, "Hello, my fellow Brit podcasters. I'm Anna, a musical journalist who studies pop culture almost to the point of blowing up down here in Brazil. I mean, I'd love to be that passionate, but I study it to the point of feeling full, not blowing up. Right now, only 4 non-Brazilian acts are in the top 20. The usual suspects, Ed the Red Sheeran, Coldplay with the You Don't Have an Idea of How Huge They Are in Brazil Right Now, Chainsmokers, Selena and Tygo, and probably because of Lollapalooza that just happened here and had the weekend as headliner, Starboy. Most of it is composed by two genres, Brazilian funk and Brazilian country, which are really not like American funk or American country. Our funk is kind of a predecessor to trap music, and after being really aggressive for years, is going through a Drake sensitive and pop phase. As an example, the current number one is a song called, pardon my pronunciation on this, Voce Partiu Meu Coração, by Nego de Borel, featuring Anitta and Wesley Safadão. Já passou, tá resolvido, segue em frente, desapega, mas se eu rebolar, duvido que você não desespera. Te esquecer não foi problema, o problema é resolver essa chuva de esquema que eu tenho que atender. Segunda eu encontro a vizinha de cima, na terça eu encontro a vizinha do lado. I'm not going to say that again, but that's the current number one.
I think you did a sterling job with the pronunciation, much better than I would have done.
I really didn't. Anna goes on to say, the singer who does the sort of featuring section on that, Anitta, is of Lady Gaga proportions in terms of fame in Brazil. She says she also is a feature in the biggest country record right now, which is Simone and Simaria's Louca, which features Anitta. And she's put in brackets, I don't think this one is terrible, by the way. It is sure catchy. And she's absolutely right. But what this has to do with country music as we might experience it, even the super, super plasticky end of country music has nothing to do with, you know, sonically to do with this noise. So this is Louca by Simone and Simaria featuring Anitta.
It's funny, it's one of those things where you hear music that is so different from your experience of music that it takes a little while to get your head around it. The quality that I really liked about these two songs and also their videos, which are very charming, is they are nakedly cheesy, or at least they code that way to me, in a way that like our pop music at least attempts to think of itself as like being more sophisticated than that. But I kind of appreciated the sheer glossiness of it. What did you think?
It has an entirely, you're right, it has a different aesthetic set of values. So certainly from a British perspective, where cool is such an enormous part of what we look for in our singers and pop stars, and none of these people looked to our eyes cool, I don't think. They didn't look like that, you know, they just looked like fairly ordinary looking people who were expressing some kind of emotive situation through music. So and that's fascinating, because it makes pop music look like something that is so coded in language, which is partly why I reacted in the way I did to the first email, is you suddenly realise just how much of your own cultural upbringing you're bringing to the table when you say you like pop music.
So on to this week's top 10, where nothing has changed except everything has sort of changed.
Yeah, there's been a coup.
A major unseating. So at number 10 is Ed Sheeran with Castle on the Hill, which I'm curious about why this one is dropping so precipitously compared to the other Ed Sheeran songs that are in the top 10. I mean, like you were saying earlier, it's always been the B-side to Shape of You, but then also I think it doesn't necessarily code as like a spring into summer song in the same way that Shape of You does. Shape of You is clearly aimed at more of a streaming audience, whereas maybe Castle on the Hill is that slightly older audience. He might have been favouring that one.
Yeah, and I wonder if Castle on the Hill isn't just having the kind of chart career that that song would always have, because it isn't. I mean, Shape of You is becoming a song of the year. It's becoming a Get Lucky or a, you know, Blurred Lines, or the kind of song that is just inescapably everywhere. And I think this is a nice song. Every time I hear the beginning on the radio, I think, oh, it's the opening bars of Shut Up and Dance by Walk the Moon. So I'm slightly aware that it's a 2 years out of date song sonically anyway, and you know, so I think it's the people who like it, it will strike probably on a more personal level, and it won't have that iconic status that Shape of You has, and it probably wouldn't have done quite as well in the top 10 if it had been the fourth single off of the album, but because it was one of two songs that were available before any of the other ones, it's, you know, it's pulled more than its weight. So in a sense it's the plucky trier of a song rather than the, you know, the imperial superhero of a song that Shape of You has turned out to be.
I haven't really been listening to Radio 1 particularly intensely recently because the whole album appeared in the singles chart at once. Have they just been playing lots of different singles, different songs from the album? I'm curious about whether after Castle on the Hill and Galway Girl and Shape of You have dropped out of the top 10, should that ever happen, whether we'll see other songs from Divide kind of climb back up again, whether they'll get repushed to radio or whether radio is already just playing variations on all of them anyway. Do you know?
I don't think... I think they've been basically playing the three big charting ones. Certainly Heart FM have been, which is my teenager's radio station of choice. I think what will happen is that he will make a video for one of the other songs and then that will push people to listen to that song more. And again, this is why I think that YouTube should be included in the chart stats, because that should have a direct effect. What it will have is a knock-on effect so that people will go back to that song because it's suddenly, there's a video, people are talking about it, it's officially been released as a single, it will get radio play then, therefore people will stream it more, therefore it will start to climb the charts.
Yeah, I mean, Galway Girl doesn't even have a video yet. My theory is that as soon as it drops out of the top five, that's when they'll launch a video to kind of get it to zoom right back up to the top. Also, can you imagine how potentially glorious that video is going to be? I would like to storyboard that thing so badly.
It storyboards itself, surely. Actually, the thing with that is I want him to double down now. We've laughed at Galway Girl so many times, but I want Ed Sheeran to make it the most St. Patrick's Day video you've ever seen, you know, where the river is literally green and they're describing... they're doing everything that he describes in it. I don't want it to be in any way abstracted from the reality of the lyrics. It's like, no, we're going full Irish with this. There's, you know, everything, every global stereotype you ever had about people from Ireland, it's in the Galway Girl video. Otherwise, why bother?
So at number nine is Kygo and Selena Gomez with It Ain't Me.
Yeah, now the interesting thing about Kygo is that while his top 10 history in the UK is sort of two songs long, there's Firestone from last year and this. In Norway, where he's from, he's basically Calvin Harris. So he's had four number one singles and he's had two number twos. And I was, bearing in mind the conversation that we just had about the Australian charts and the homogeneity of English language pop music, it does make you wonder whether local beats international in the global musical melting pot of dance music in some way, because it shouldn't make any odds. Certainly Kygo's not making records that sound particularly Norwegian, or they're often quite tropical sounding, or certainly part of the global Esperanto of dance music. But yet he's massively popular in Norway, much more popular there than any other country in the world.
This has led me to one of my favourite bits of Norwegian culture that I really, really like to write about, actually. So, like you're saying, although Kygo may not sound particularly Norwegian, you know, he doesn't even have that like Nordic disco thing going on, that his music plays into a really, really particular part of teenage Norwegian culture. When teenagers in Norway graduate high school when they're 16, they have a celebration called the Russ, which is for R-U-S-S. And it is a week-long celebration where it's insane. I implore you to, like, after this podcast, go away and look up some videos. We'll link some in the notes. Teenagers group together. They buy a van or a bus even. I think there's obviously a lot of wealthy parents involved in this. I have no idea what kind of the socioeconomic background of it is. They buy a bus, they decorate it in their like group's chosen team colours, and then in many instances, they if the really, really rich ones, they commission producers to write a theme song for the bus. So at a smaller level, you might get like a local person to do it, and it's always some, you know, quite big, horrible, grinding EDM thing. But then the really, really rich kids are commissioning super DJs to do it, or they're commissioning people who then kind of go on to greater success. So Kygo did a Russ song in 2015 for a group of kids. In 2011, Skrillex did a Russ song. So I think that was like just before he's absolutely massive. And yeah, they drive these buses around for a week. They get absolutely legless. It's kind of like a nationally sanctioned thing. Everybody wears red, which may be what Russ means. I'm not quite sure. And it is... yeah, state-sanctioned teenage debauchery set to grinding EDM music. If there is not some kind of like brilliant teenage movie about this culture in a few years, somebody is not doing their job right, because it is horrifying and impressive and just so different to anything we might get up to here. Like when I'm at school, on your last day of school when you were 16, you got to like, you know, chop your skirt up a little bit and go around being slightly naughty, but not hiring a bus and terrorising a town with EDM.
What do the alt kids do then? Are they just driving around? They've got like some Daniel Johnston-esque song about we've got a bus. I mean, there must be layers to it, because I mean, either that or rich kids in Norway with the EDM thing are absolutely insufferable, and everybody else is just like, oh, you're doing the roost, like it's like spring break or something.
Yeah, don't they sound like the most obnoxious kids? I mean, there's really not very much that's been written in English about this, but yeah, like you say, I'm really conscious about the inclusivity of it, and also I think I've read some quite horrible stuff about like sexual abuse of girls happening during these weeks, but yeah, for something like Kygo, which we look at as being pretty antiseptic, pretty much not tethered to any kind of community, he has definitely got like these links with this really, really specific Norwegian thing. I mean, I'm not saying that his Rush song is responsible for his great success, but he is part of that culture that is totally weird, really weird and totally different from anything that we have.
I mean, one thing, I mean, if you've seen the film The World's End, the Simon Pegg, Nick Frost film The World's End?
In fact, that was filmed where I live, so yes, I have.
Yes, well, there you go. That whole film is about the greatest time of your life, the time when you're 18 and music means everything and all of that, and it's got that soundtrack, which is, you know, those songs. I would imagine that if Kygo provided the soundtrack to that moment in the lives of teenagers, the loyalty that you'd get from that for the rest of their lives, it would always be, no, Kygo's our guy, you know, he was there, he made that music for our bus, and in that bus that thing happened, or those things happened that have become legendary in my life. So you can sort of see if that's why, you know, that he's elevated status is because he's willing to provide this stuff, and then people are going off and doing astonishing things, and he's literally providing the soundtrack of a moment that Ed Sheeran would write a song about later on.
Yeah. Oh my God. Please bring on Ed Sheeran's Rush song. Can somebody alert him to this culture? Right. At number 8 is Zed and Stay featuring Alicia Cara.
Now Zed, he's been testing out our theory about proven chart stars who've had a bit of a career dip making their resurgence with a dance producer. So, but he's already released a song with Selena Gomez, I Want You to Know, which was, you know, relative success, number 17 hit from 2015. But he did last year release True Colors, which was Kesha's first single in 3 years, and tellingly the first single since all of the legal stuff blew up around her allegations of sexual assault from the producer Dr. Luke. And sadly, it failed to reach the UK top 40. And this was despite a certain amount of critical acclaim that Kesha had never had before. People had never been critically fond of Kesha because, you know, she was one of those people who came out with a couple of pop songs about being very drunk that made it look like society was on the brink of implosion. And it does mean that this dance route to reborn success is clearly not foolproof.
I think one thing that may have been acting against Kesha's interests at that point is I have a feeling that if that was released through her regular label, they probably would not have been pushing it. But yes, I do agree. But curiously, at number 7 is Martin Jensen and Solo Dance, and which has been a massive success. This has been sticking around for weeks and weeks and weeks. But I realised that we had never talked about who the singer was, apart from the fact that she had submitted her vocal to this like Facebook talent contest type thing that he did in a kind of impromptu way. But interesting, she wants to stay anonymous. He made a little video with her about recording the song, and she's always got a huge sheet of hair in front of her face, and you never hear her speaking voice. Then you would think that now, like, singers will be queuing up to do things with Martin Jensen if he can have a song that has this kind of staying power. I thought it was very interesting that she just, like, isn't interested. You wonder whether she's just a normal person who got lucky and has no designs of being a pop star, or whether she's biding her time for her own thing.
That would be really interesting if she never ever turns up, and then in 10 years' time they do You Won't Believe What the Singer of Solo Dance Looks Like Now.
We didn't know what she looked like in the first place. Right, number 6, The Chainsmokers and Coldplay, Something Just Like This.
Now, this is, depending on which way you're going, this is either the last or the first of a block of 5 songs that have been knocked down from the number 1 spot by the song that we will come to talk about when we get to the number one spot. And it's, you know, it's so basically it's in exactly the same place as it was last week, and we reserve the right to make exactly the same comment that we've made about it since the beginning of this podcast, which is jolly well done, you are superheroes to us.
Number 5, Drake and Passion Fruit.
Now, this is a song which the title to which I assumed was like a Love Cucumber type sexual reference, but Laura has the exact opposite view.
Yeah, I think this song is definitely about lady parts. There's this great artist called Stephanie Sali, who I think puts a lot of her work on Instagram, And she makes all of these very sexy videos with fruit. So she cuts a piece of fruit in half so you can kind of see the cross section of the seeds. And I think she puts yogurt on her her index finger and her middle finger, but you can't really see it. And then she kind of caresses the middle of the fruit. And it's like, it's very sensual in this very weird way. And I saw her doing one with the passion fruit where she sticks her fingers right into the seeds. And that is very much what I think of when I listen to this song. And I can say that it only enhances my experience of it.
Either way, it's about a love that has gone off like a 3-day-old fruit salad. So yeah, we can move on now. Number four is Clean Bandit featuring Zara Larsson with Symphony. We've basically covered this. It's a love song in which love is described as if it is music.
Curiously, so I've heard a lot of American pop radio this week, which plays the same song literally twice in 20 minutes. I heard Rockabye, which is Clean Bandit and Anne Marie, like literally twice in 20 minutes the other day. And curiously, that is the song that is still doing big things on radio over here. I haven't heard Symphony once. Anyway, moving on. Number three, Ed Sheeran and Galway Girl.
Now, the midweeks had Galway Girl at number two and Shape of You at number three, which might indicate that there's a swap on the way between those two songs. And it will be really interesting to see if this week's number one stays there the following week. We'll get into this a little bit later on, but none of the young people that I have polled about the current number one actually like it, and you'd think they would. So we'll get onto this in a little while.
But they're all fans of Galway Girl.
Yeah, they love it. They're to the point of they'll put Galway Girl on in the car now just to annoy me, because they know that I've wearied of its charms, and then they'll put on Rude by Magic. So I need to not tell people what songs really wind me up, because certainly people that I live with, because they will torture me with it.
So at number two, the dethroned Ed Sheeran, Shape of You, now number two, no longer number one. It cannot break, Bryan Adams' streaming record or Drake's almost streaming record from last year.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think we've had our experiences with this song, because it did seem to be like the figurehead for an invasion of the charts. And it happened at a time when you had just reviewed the album. And I think I think the album is not as good as his other albums. You have very strong opinions about the album, but I think both of us really like Shape of You, and you've come to like it more recently, haven't you?
Well, I really didn't like it. I found it really, really annoying, and I can pick holes in it forever. But yeah, this week, through kind of relentless exposure to the radio, because in Los Angeles, you can't get public transport. You have to get in Ubers if you want to go anywhere, any great distance. It's on every time I get in a car. And every time I hear those little opening, like, do, do, do parts, I think, oh, yeah, I like this. And then I remember what it is. And I had an experience a couple of weeks ago where that happened for the first time. And I was like, oh, I can't believe he got me. I don't like this. But now I'm finally coming around to it. I'm even finding the hokey lyrics about, like, you know, we talk for hours and hours about the sweet and the sour. I'm starting to think that these are brilliant. So, you know, come back in 6 months, you might find me having, like, completely disowned my Ed Sheeran review and being like, actually, album of the year 2017, he's brilliant.
I think we ought to always examine the possibility that we've been 100% wrong about stuff. And I don't think it means that the people who always liked a thing are right either. I think, you know, there are definitely going to be people who are sick of Shape of You now, who really liked it when it first came out. And there are definitely going to be people that are only just starting to warm up to it now. And I think that can happen with any song at any point. It's all, you know, this thing is, you know, it's a journey, isn't it? We've all been on a little musical journey. And I think we should move on to the number one, because it does open up a whole can of worms. So this week's number one is Harry Styles with Sign of the Times.
When I saw this news last, I got, you know, you get the little chartsy mod to your inbox a couple of hours before they do the charts. I actively, like, involuntarily cheered. One escaped my mouth. I was so delighted that this has happened.
I have listened to nothing else with the same frequency as I've listened to Sign of the Times over the last 7 days. I've had to make up the most listened to song of the week, because there's something about it that has just completely floored me. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful song. I love the way he sings "Why Are We Always Stuck and Running from the Bullets." I love the fact that he's put the word bullets in a very commercial sounding chart headed pop song, because it's one of those hooks. It's like George Michael used to talk about putting in lines like "a prisoner that has his own key" or "guilty feet have got no rhythm," these little hook lines just to draw the attention. And I think, why are we always stuck and running from the bullets, given that there is no other context to what is going on in there in the narrative of the song up until that point, is an incredible hook, because you're just like, what bullets, where, what are we talking about, who is we, you know? And and the way that he sings it is so tear-stained. It's a beautiful pop moment.
Do you know that website genius.com where people annotate lyrics?
Yes.
So I had a look at that earlier to see what the theories were about it, and obviously the whole "why are we always stuck and running from the bullets" part, people were saying, well, this is definitely about One Direction, it's definitely about how stuck he feels and the fact that he wants to get out. But I think that, you know, going back to our discussion last week about the various ways that ex-boy band members can encode messages into their debut solo singles, one of the things that I really like about Sign of the Times, and also the new song that he just played on SNL, which we're going to get onto, maybe I'm missing something, you know, I'm no One Direction aficionado, I don't know that much about them, but it doesn't seem to be that much of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge thing about, like, that was my past and I've escaped it and I'm different now. And one of the things I really, really love about the way that he styled his comeback is, so on the SNL performance last night, I think that's the first time we've seen him play any of these new songs. After him doing like a really brilliant Mick Jagger impersonation as part of a skit they were doing, he comes on and he's wearing this beautiful suit and he's got his hair all kind of tousled and slicked back, and he's playing guitar. And it's very much like, I am a serious artist, but he's not doing the serious artist thing in any way that says, and F you, teenage girls, I don't want you to be any part of this anymore. This week he put out the artworks of the album, and it's all kind of like very pink and very girlish and intimate looking. And the writer Maria Sherman wrote a really, really great piece for Billboard decoding everything that he's built into that artwork. I am really excited about this album, and I think that there's going to be some kind of scheme in it that reveals itself once we hear a few more songs. I really love the way that for a really grand pop comeback, the two songs that he's released so far are basically him saying, I have no idea what's going on and I'm searching for answers and I'm as despairing as anybody else. On one hand, there's this very kind of like relatable, I don't know, humble is the right word for a like superstar pop star, but I think there's something really liberating in him saying, I don't know what's going on. But then also on the other hand, I like how he hit number one on Easter weekend. He performed live for the first time on Easter weekend on SNL, and it's very much encoded into it like, I am risen. I am here now.
Yes, Pop Jesus is here. The other thing is that this is the second massively dystopian pop hit of the year after Katy Perry's Slave to the Rhythm. So it's interesting to note and to wonder whether pop music is starting to pick up on a certain feeling that we're politically on shaky ground, have become more on shaky ground over the last year, or, you know, and whether people are feeling a little worried, because this is a terrified sounding song. Slave to the Rhythm, although easily mocked as being kind of Katy Perry goes woke, hashtag woke, and contains that slightly annoying universal we, where it's, are we all doing this? Are we all looking at selfies when we should be paying attention to the important things in life? The fact is that a major league pop star is starting to say something about the fact that we all live in a bubble, and we can't see the trouble. And the odd thing is, it took Adam Buxton reading out the lyrics to Slave to the Rhythm on his podcast recently to make me go, oh no, I understand what this song is about now. And I had completely missed it. And I thought it was a weirdly slow song about how brilliant it is to go dancing. But it's that mournful quality to it that I was like, this is too slow and too sad to be a dance banger. What the hell is this? And I know this is obvious, and it's one of those moments where you just go, oh yeah, no, I'm an idiot. It's clearly her saying, we are obsessed with a thing that we shouldn't be obsessed with, and as a society, this is crazy. But the only reason anybody's listening to her sing about that is because she's Katy Perry, the famous pop star. So it has that duality to it. But I do think it's interesting that pop seems to be heading in a dystopian direction. And I do wonder whether that is actually of more use to people's feelings in these unsettled times than a million singer-songwriters writing protest songs about situations, because that is what they essentially do, isn't it, singer-songwriters? It's, you know, they're already riddled with global ennui before they even put pen to paper. Whereas for the guy out of One Direction to come back for his triumphant resurrection and say and sing a song which is like, oh blimey, life is a little stressful at the moment, and I don't think it's going to get any better. To have allusions to dying, and I'll, you know, within his rebirth is either an act of monumental ego, which you don't suspect from Harry Styles. You don't suspect he is that monumental and egotist, or he's a sensitive person writing about the times in which he lives.
Totally. So yeah, the new song is called, or the one that he played on SNL last night, is called Ever Since New York, and it's this like beautiful, quite compact, almost like country tinge rock song, I think. And in that, you know, obviously he's singing about New York, and the two fan theories that are proliferating about this so far is that it's either about 9/11, which I think is possibly unlikely, or it's about Taylor Swift, which, you know, they're two very different kinds of apocalypse, but they're both very valid readings.
That's definitely people just putting together stuff that they know. It's like when it's like in any fandom, I can speak to Doctor Who fandom because I'm aware of it, that when you see a picture of a new person in Doctor Who, the fandom immediately runs down the list of all of the characters that have ever been in it and goes, is it this one? Is it the Rani? And the actual truth of it is probably something less obvious. And certainly, I think he would be foolish beyond all recognition to write a song about Taylor Swift. That would be a mad thing to do at this point.
Yeah, I really have a feeling that that's not going to happen. But yeah, I'm very excited to hear more songs from the album, and also to read him talking about it as well, because it does seem like there is some kind of overarching thing to it. Yes. Well done, Harry Styles. Thanks so much for giving us something new to talk about.
Let's have a look at other songs that may trouble the top 10 over the next couple of weeks. We've got this week's High Climbers. The Disciples On My Mind has jumped from number 81 to number 34, which is usually a good sign that they're going to keep going up and may eventually become the new Martin Jensen.
The next Martin Jensen. Yeah.
And I have a feeling this is going to test our powers of conversation over the next few weeks. So let's keep our powder dry and just say, and just keep an eye on that one and see what happens, because I don't want to have to talk about it until something happens to it. But let's hear a clip now. This is Disciples and On My Mind. Or is this love that I'm feeling? You stay. So that was Disciples and On My Mind. Also, we need to keep an eye on, this is kind of interesting bearing in mind the Australian charts, is that Lorde's Green Light, a song that we flagged up ages ago as being definitely the sort of thing that we should be seeing in the top 10, has been steadily rising through the charts over the past few weeks and has gone up from number 27 to number 20, which is its highest position yet. Now, Laura, you've got stuff to say about Lorde, haven't you?
Yes. Well, two things. I'll start with the less exciting one. There's a brilliant profile of her in the New York Times Magazine this week, which you can read for free online. And in that, she talks about how, because she made this whole album with Jack Antonoff from X of Fun and of Bleachers. And but I think she consulted other people along the way. And she said that when she played Green Light to Max Martin, I think he said that he liked it, but he said to her, the maths of this song is all wrong. It's not going to work. And she was like, well, thanks for your input, but I don't care. And you can kind of see that he's right in that it's not been an immediate success. And a lot of people I've spoken to about it while I've been away this week have said that, you know, they don't quite get it and they find the shift too jarring. I really love the shift. But I think that was very interesting that she kind of went against Max Martin's foolproof pop rules. But my more exciting experience with this song this week is, so this weekend is Coachella. I was coming to LA on holiday with a friend and I had no idea that it was the same time as Coachella. It was purely a coincidence. And I didn't really want to try and go because it's a bit hot. I think I would perish in the desert. But on Thursday, Lorde tweeted that at 5 p.m. on Friday, she would be tweeting something exciting about something that was happening that evening and to keep an eye on her account. So I made sure that I was within distance of Wi-Fi on Friday evening at 5 o'clock and sat furiously refreshing outside a cafe whose internet I was stealing. And she tweeted a link to buy tickets to a show at a venue called Pappy and Harriet's, which is this tiny little shack in the desert about 2.5 hours drive east of LA. And I clicked through and I managed to get two tickets and just sat there in a state of total shock, like, wait, is this actually happening? I thought this would be incredibly hard, but somehow I've done it. And so me and my friend Eve drove out to the desert on Friday night and we watched Lorde play in essentially a minuscule pub, which has a capacity of 244 people. And because we really we wanted to make sure that we got there on time. So we got there about 3 hours before she came on stage. So we were about 10th in the queue to get in. We were in the second row of the gig, and it was just incredible. Like, it was such a low ceiling show that, like, you had to kind of, and it was so tight and packed in, proper bum to bum stuff, that you were constantly having to dodge and dive to try and see her, even from like the close vantage point that we had. And she did a lot of old stuff. She did the Magnet song that she did with Disclosure, and then of the new material she did Green Light, which was incredible. She started the show by doing the first verse, that really mournful one, and everybody thought, oh, she's going to do all of Green Light. But then she stops and she goes into Tennis Courts instead, so she just played that mournful part. And then she came back to it at the end and she did the whole thing, and she was just kind of like writhing and dancing and looking like she was having so much fun. You know when you can hear that somebody's grinning from the way that they're singing? It was just like that the whole time. And you could make, the brilliant thing about the video to Green Light is the eye contact that she holds in it, especially at the end, and holding that eye contact with Lorde making Green Light, playing Green Light, and Misa in front of you was just one of the greatest nights of my life. And she also did Liability, which was really, really beautiful. And then she did another two-part new song called Sober. And the first part of Sober, I have to say, I thought it does sound a little bit like Taylor Swift and Zayn's I Don't Want to Live Forever, but it's still brilliant. And also I need to listen to it a lot more from the slightly dodgy bootleg recording that I made of it. But then the second part of it sounds like, it sounds like a George Michael ballad. It sounds a bit like Lou Reed on Berlin. It's really, really dramatic. She's saying in it like, you told us that you wanted melodrama. Like, you know, now you've got what you came for. And it was so beautiful. And yeah, I cannot wait to hear more songs. I think she actually performs at Coachella on Sunday night, which will be last night by the time this podcast comes out. So maybe there'll be some more new material that we haven't heard. But yes, thanks, Lorde. That was amazing.
And the title of Jammiest Person of the Week goes to you. Well done. Well done. That sounds incredible.
I did have to send Fraser an email on Friday being like, could we postpone recording the podcast on Saturday morning? Because I think that I might not have had very much sleep. I promise it's for a good reason. So yes, I was not awake at 7 a.m. on Saturday. I didn't get back until about 4:30, but it was very worth it.
Okay, well, and from that very notable experience to perhaps the oddest chart riser of the week, Swallow by Jason Derulo and Nicki Minaj has moved from number 34 to number 24.
Girl, no swallow nothing, word to the Dalai Lama. He know I'm a fashion killer, word to John Galliano. He cupping that Valentino, ain't no telling me no. I'm that bitch that he know. Like how your wife in these thoughts, you don't get wins for that. I'm having another good year, we don't get blimps for that. This the gang still cold, we don't get minks for that. When I'm popping them bananas, we don't link chimps for that. Okay, these bitches 2 years, now you're
talking. What I like about this song is that it's cartoon dirty. It's dirty in a way that is so over the top that it does make you think, I'm still not massively convinced that Jason Derulo has ever had sex with anybody but himself. You know, it's just like he's so desperate to prove that he could totally do any amount of women that you threw at him at any point that it's like, really? Why would you need to prove that? Why is it important to you to say that? Isn't, I mean, most people would just assume that that would be, that you'd be fine with, you know, procreating with somebody who you fancied. That's not a problem. And then in the video, there's another jarring moment, really, is that the video is so, like, he's got four women in a row and they're bouncing on the floor, and it's these women are very much being treated as objects. And then Nicki Minaj pops up to do her guest verse, and it's literally like a chair has just started rapping, because the women have, these women shaped objects have been so sleazily looked over throughout the entire video, and then suddenly one of them starts talking. Oh, right, okay.
You do believe in women as autonomous objects?
Yeah, no, I think they might well be. Yeah, it's the way in which the visuals have been sort of delivered, and then suddenly, oh, we've got one of them in to do some talking as well. But I think it's going to do rather well, actually, this, because it's just silly. I have no problems with sex in music being silly, because there's too much heroic in music at the moment anyway.
Also, it's Controller for summer 2017, which is also fine.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, other new releases.
Yes, well, these are songs that have literally just been dropped, as they say. So Lady Gaga is back with a song called The Cure. And I need to tell you, Laura, a story from my teenage years about an upsetting shopping trip. When I was 17, I went shopping with my friend Justine, and we were proper alt kids, you know. And we'd go shopping in the Bristol record shops, and we went to this place that had a single by, and I knew that this was a single by a group called Boys Don't Cry. And they had a song called Who the Yam Dam Do You Think You Am? Okay, it was awful, but I knew it I knew that it existed. And I don't think my friend Justine did. But what made it really frustrating for her was that the B-side of that song was called The Cure. So she had read Boys Don't Cry on the front, The Cure on the back, and went, oh, well, this must be Boys Don't Cry by The Cure. And bought the single, took it back to her house and put it on. And it was this really odd, eccentric sort of synth funk, desperate for chart success type song. And the thing is, I kind of had to say, I already knew that it wasn't the song. I said, oh, I thought you liked this. And she was like, no, what is this? Oh my God. She was so furious. And I think, I think it may be one of the sort of key reasons why we don't really speak anymore. All I would say is to urge Lady Gaga not to name a song after one of the most famous indie bands in British music history.
No, I can only imagine what The Cure's song Lady Gaga would sound like. I can't like to hear that now. So baby, tell me yes, and I will give you everything. So baby, tell me yes, and I will be all yours tonight. So baby, tell me yes, and I will give you everything. Your side. If I can't find the cure, I'll fix you with my love. No matter what you know, I'll fix you with my love. And if you say you're okay, I'm gonna heal you anyway. I like this song, and I do, it's about kind of unconditional love and having a very tender relationship with somebody. And I wonder if she has released it as, kind of in keeping with the Harry Styles, Katy Perry thing, as a salve to the global ache of the moment. I really like it as a song. It very much reminds me of Carly Rae Jepsen and also of a Tegan and Sarah album from 2007 called The Con, which had a song on it called The Cure, which is uncanny.
They're all at it.
Yes, they're all at it. I think it's a good song, but I also feel like it's a sad statement of defeat over Joanne, which, Lady Gaga's earlier albums are not necessarily something that I would listen to for fun, but the kind of slightly country-tinged, songwritery qualities of Joanne is right up my street. And it's, I don't know if there's something sad about her having to say, okay, right, here's the kind of pop banger you're actually hoping for, not my, beautiful tone poems about my late aunt who I never met. What do you think?
Well, I think that's right, because it's really interesting that she would pitch herself back in the chart sounds of now. There's that high-pitched ghost voice sample that kicks it off, which is straight out of Sorry by Justin Bieber. It's got that chuntery 80s funk guitar that you would hear on a lot of Haim records. And the chorus is a four-chord saturated synth churn. It's kind of anthemic. It's very sonically, it is so 2017, whereas everything she's been doing up until now, including Joanne, which has got huge swathes of AOR blood running through its veins, and the jazz duet stuff she's been doing with Tony Bennett sort of took her out of time with regards to what current pop music was doing. I think you're right. I think there is that slight feeling of disappointment almost that she's now speaking the same language as everybody else in the charts, where she invented this whole new lexicon for herself. I guess I would hate to automatically assume that there was a commercial reason for that. It might be that she just really likes what's going on at the moment, musically speaking. And certainly people gave her a lot of extra credit in her early years for revolutionising the sound of pop music, where I don't know that Just Dance does that, and certainly nothing up until the chant in Bad Romance is particularly sonically revolutionary. Visually, yeah, but sonically not so much. So maybe she's just like, no, I'm keeping up, it's fine. And I think it's a good song.
You've also mentioned that we should keep an eye out for Royal Blood with Lights Out, but I am, I'm going to make you a bet now, the first on Break My Chart bet, 50p that this never breaks the top 20. A pound that it never breaks the top 40.
Do I have to take this bet? Because I think you're probably right. I did want to talk about it because it's got this thing. What is it with rock bands at the moment, particularly within the indie sphere, and sort of suspect white liquid? And I'm talking about, you've seen the cover of the Last Kings of Leon album.
Oh,
that,
yes.
That
yeah.
Weird four faces coming out of a bath of milk.
It's quite hypnosis, isn't it?
Yeah, but And just an odd, they were kind of slightly androgynous versions of the Kings of Leon, although some of them had beards. And the new video for Lights Out has basically that for its concept, only they're in a room which is made of that white liquid.
It's a lot of potentially naked ladies frolicking in milk. There's a part, I think, at the point where the song peaks or crescendos or whatever, where the video zooms in on a woman who's sitting in this lake of so-called milk and spreading her legs very wide and looming into the camera, and it's really like...
Have you seen what she's doing, though?
Oh, yeah, she's holding something in her hands. I can't remember what it is.
It's a light switch. She's flicking a light switch, which is held between her legs at the place where you'd expect there to be something. She's flicking a light switch. I mean, I can't imagine what visual metaphor they're trying to conjure there. I just can't see it.
It's a good way to short circuit.
But that moment corresponds with my favourite moment in the song, which is this really spectacularly dim drum break, which kind of just goes ba-dum, 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 9 times it does that, which is so stupid as to be fantastic. Like, I find that bit incredibly thrilling. I appreciate that you're not so much of a fan of Royal Blood, and I'm not a massive fan, but that bit is ace.
Yes, I think it's fair to say that they have not really changed track for their second album, but, you know, good luck to them. Fraser, what was your most streamed song this week, apart from Harry Styles, which we have already discussed?
Well, that's it. Because I've been listening to nothing but Harry Styles for a week, I deliberately picked something that was quick to assimilate. And what I've picked is I Win by Lethal Bizzle featuring Skepta. Let's hear a moment of that now.
I win, don't want to see me shining, I win. You don't want to honor my thing, I win. Your girl watching my thing, I win. Every day I go in, I win. See the diamond in my ring, I win. That's a diamond for a king. Don't know why MCs want to try a thing when you know all you're going to get is a merkin. Yeah. What have you actually done? Apart from be forced to sell drugs and hold a gun. Now you're talking like it's fun. Said that you've made it, blood, let me ask your mum. Chasing dough, that's why you get none. You man are washed up, that's why you get spun. Mumsy said she done having kids, she see me on TV, now she want a next song.
So that's I Win by Lethal Bizzle, which is a combination of Grime's most critically lauded artist, which is Skepta, and the least critically lauded, because Lethal Bizzle is funny, and I think people, you know, as with all critically lauded musical genres, the people who are funny get the least credit, because funny is apparently easy, which I don't agree with at all. But what's interesting is that if we're saying that the streaming of music has created a kind of homogeneity of sound where bands are all starting to sound like each other so that they can get on the same mix playlist so that people can find out about them, and, you know, that's how music is being shared. We could also say that Grime manages to sidestep this just by simply brutally repeating the same hook so fast and so often within a song that you can absorb the song straight away within a minute of it starting, to the point where by 2.5 minutes you can become bored of the song just through overhearing it, not, you know, in the same way that you would get bored of a song after listening to it 50 times, because the repetition of the hooks is so frequent, once every bar, once every 2 bars, but they actually make poetry out of that limitation. And I think this is a really good example of that, because at some points in the song, the repetition is 1 bar in, it comes back around and back around each time. And you can go through this cycle of being thrilled and then bored in a Grime song, and this one is only 3 minutes long, which is the opposite of the Harry Styles thing, which is a 6-minute long song that takes its time to worm its way into your consciousness.
I honestly haven't listened to anything. My iPod has remained untouched in my bag. So I am actually going to have to say that my most listened song this week is Shape of You, because I've heard it every time I've got into a car, and I am having a newfound shameful love affair with it that I should, you know, try and hide for everybody and carry on in secret. So yeah, Ed Sheeran is my most listened to song of the week.
Congratulations, Ed. While you have slipped from the number one in the actual charts, you've now achieved the dubious honour of being the number one in our charts. So well done.
We can't let him lie. That's it for another week of Unbreak My Chart. Thanks so much for listening and subscribing. You can email your thoughts on the charts or reviews of any particular songs or artists to unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com. Thanks to everybody who's been listening and getting in touch. If we've not got your email yet, we will do next week. Also, if you're listening outside the UK, as with Anna and Thomas, please do let us know what's going on in your home chart, because it's great fun kind of listening way outside of our sphere.
And if you want to listen to any of the songs we've discussed in this week's podcast, we've put all the good ones, and that for once, this will have to include Ed Sheeran.
Shape of You, yeah.
Into a Spotify playlist, and it'll be linked to in the show notes.
And you can find us both on Twitter. I am at Laura Snapes.
I'm at @CSI_popmusic.
Our producer is a great Tay Mawson, and we'd also love it if you left us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye.